Chapter 17. The Stranger's Power. We may infer from these facts what havoc the introduction of any new beast of prey must cause in a country before the instincts of the aborigines become adapted to the stranger's craft or power. Charles Darwin, Journal of Researches. In the Galapagos, large tracts of the highlands of Floriana, Santiago, San Cristobal, and Santa Cruz have been cleared for cattle pasture. Farmers have planted tomatoes, avocados, guavas, papaya, oranges, lemons, bananas, potatoes, cabbages, coffee, and a fruit known locally as Norwegian pear. On Santa Cruz, which is in sight of Daphne Major, the dirt road up through the highlands and over the summit of the island is full of wide views of these young orchards and pastures, and dotted with small white crosses, like wayside shrines, to commemorate fatal car accidents. Horses, donkeys, cows, and cattle egrets, all of them like human beings new to the islands, stand in the fields, through which a few giant Galapagos tortoises still wander or browse in green pond scum with Darwin's finches riding on their domes. The tortoises help the farmers by eating grapefruit, oranges, and lemons whenever they can, and dispersing the seeds throughout the uplands. The biggest settlement in the archipelago is the village of Puerto Ayora, on the southern shore of Santa Cruz. Darwin's finches are the sparrows of the village. In the cafes, while men call greetings to one another, mock distinguished epithets, capitán, profesor, the finches hop beneath their feet, looking for crumbs and spills. They hunt and peck in every dooryard garden and bathe in puddles in the middle of the dirt roads, braving the bicycles and pickup trucks. The local people call the finches chiques for the sound. They know the birds are famous, but they don't know why. They simply call them chiques, all of the finches, from the small-beaked to the big-beaked. The warblers are marias or canarios. Darwin knew that the finches could adjust their habits quickly to take advantage of the banquets spread by human beings. In the highlands of Floriana, he watched the birds stealing seeds from the fields of the Ecuadorian political prisoners. The grosbeaks are very injurious to the cultivated land, Darwin writes in his ornithological notes. They stock up seeds and plants, buried 6 inches beneath the surface. Similarly, Alfred Russel Wallace, in an essay on the variability of species, tells the story of the kea, a mountain parrot of New Zealand. Before Europeans began raising sheep in New Zealand, the kea fed on the honey of flowers and on the insects that buzzed around the flowers, rounding out its diet with fruits and berries. Soon after shepherds came to New Zealand, keas began picking at sheepskins hung out to dry and the mutton hung up to cure. Then shepherds began finding sheep with raw and bleeding wounds on their backs. About 1868, Wallace says, some of the shepherds actually saw the parrots attacking their sheep. Since then, Wallace reports, it is stated that the bird actually burrows into the living sheep, eating its way down to the kidneys, which form its special delicacy. The shepherds, meanwhile, declared war on the parrots, shooting them on sight. The case, Wallace concludes, affords a remarkable instance of how the climbing feet and powerful hooked beak developed for one set of purposes can be applied to another altogether different purpose. And it also shows how little real stability there may be in what appear to us the most fixed habits of life. In the Galapagos, the lives of the settlers and Darwin's finches have almost instantly intertwined. Finches eat the flowers of the crops, says Fabio Peñafil, a young Ecuadorian naturalist and Galapagos guide who lives in the village of Puerto Ayora. The señora who lives next to me has had to give up planting pineapple in her garden, he says, because of the finches picking in the middle. Cactus finches and tree finches. It's nibble, 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 and no fruit will come out. The señora has eaten finches. Yes, she says they have a very mild taste. She makes finch soup. And of course she tells me that. She says, your finches, your silly finches have eaten my plants, but I have eaten the finches. highly illegal finch soup. The people at the station would just fall on their backs. But she was honest enough to tell me, imagine what the people up in the highlands are doing when the finches are eating their crops. And after all, the finch population is probably increasing up there because of those crops. I don't like sentimentality. Facts are facts. At the Charles Darwin Research Station, which is just outside the village, Darwin's finches hop in the gravel between the low buildings, hunting for seeds among the pebbles and the pocked pale coral. They look down at visiting scientists from the edges of the corrugated roofs and the railings of the dormitory porches. They perch on the arrows along the tourist footpaths as if seeking evolutionary guidance. The flocks of finches are thickest outside the station's library, where the librarian, Gail Davies, throws rice to them, wearing a shirt tied at the waist and hair pulled back in a bun, tropical librarian fashion. She also feeds the finches on the veranda of her home, a mile down the dirt road from the station. There, she dumps the rice on a hanging tray, while dozens of fuliginosa, fortis, magnerostris, and scandens hop and cling to the wires, cheeping and snatching a few grains right out of her hands. Since my husband is gone a lot, he goes out to sea very often. It's nice to have living things around, Gail says. They are there in the morning. They're there at noon. And they are hopeful all day long. If someone comes to the house when I'm away, it's like spreading a rumor. All of a sudden, there's a flock. She used to keep the rice in an open bowl in the kitchen, and some of the finches, the most confident, would fly right in and feed from the bowl. Most preferred to wait until they were served outside. But some few who didn't like to eat with the hoi polloi would come right through the window to the inside bowl and eat in peace, even if the outside bowl was full, she says. This one day, I was inside the house, sitting on the bed reading. The house we lived in then was just one room. The bed doubled as a couch by day. So I'm sitting propped up on pillows, and a finch landed on a pillow right next to my head. And I could see that he had something wrong with his beak. It was pox. Pox shows normally on feet, but sometimes you get a nasty growth on the beak inside. I managed to scrape it off. Then I painted the spot with gentian violet. I tried to help him out. I never had a finch do that before, fly right up and look into my face. They cock their heads and look at you when you are feeding them, but this was something very different. It felt, to get thoroughly anthropomorphic, like a tiny cry for help. Of course, you'll never know. It could have been that he could not eat, was basically starving, and I was the source, the one who put out the rice. Who knows? To me, it felt like a help me. The arrival of human beings means a new phase in the evolution of Darwin's finches, and its directions are still unclear. On the inhabited islands, says Peter Grant, we haven't done studies of the effects of cats, rats, mice, dogs, goats, donkeys, fire ants, pineapples, bananas, or guavas, and so on. Are they having an effect on the finches? Strictly speaking, we don't know from our studies. We assume they are, he says, but we have observed none of these changes. Rosemary and Peter do think they see something odd about the finches of Santa Cruz. The birds around the research station and in the village seem to be blurring together. The Grants have never made a systematic study of this, but to their eyes, the species almost look as though they are fusing. They just sort of run into each other, says Rosemary. There is no difference between the largest fortis and the smallest magnerostris. Really, we would need to compare the finches 100 years ago in that part of the island with what they are now, Peter says cautiously. But he and Rosemary wonder if the provision of so much water and food in Puerto Ayora may have enabled the birds' breeding densities to rise around the village. The struggle for existence may have grown less intense. As the growth of the village relaxes the selection pressures on generation after generation of finches, the birds may be turning into a hybrid swarm. This has not happened on Daphne or Genovesa because, as the finch unit has shown, the struggle for existence on those uninhabited islands is intermittently so intense. In hard times, the varied finch beaks have such great adaptive value that they are preserved again and again by natural selection. On Genovesa, for instance, late in 1983, after the Great Niño, the island was unusually lush and conditions were unusually soft for Darwin's finches, as they are all year round on Gail Davies' veranda. At that time, the depths of Conirostris and Magnirostris beaks on Genovesa were very variable, and the deepest Conirostris beak and the shallowest Magnirostris beak were close together. If conditions had continued lush, those finches would likely have continued to fuse. But the years 1984 and 1985 were one long dry period. "All the intermediates went out," says Rosemary, "died, to be more precise. All the finches whose measurements lay between Conirostris and Magnirostris died. In Magnirostris, length and depth went up. In Conirostris, they went down. As a result, the two species were divided by the selection episode," says Rosemary, gesturing with her hands as if she were drawing out a lump of clay. "The net result was divergence. You got an actual gap." So the Grants speculate that in places like Santa Cruz, where there is little selection against hybrids, some of Darwin's finches might yet merge. Human beings may have tipped the balance between fission and fusion. Around the villages and farms, many of the celebrated differences in their beaks may simply disappear. Some decades ago, the botanist Edgar Anderson wrote a speculative essay, "The Hybridization of the Habitat." Anderson is the evolutionist who coined the term introgressive hybridization to emphasize the point that the backcrossing of hybrids with the lines of either of their parents provides a means for the mixing of genes between the two lines, and so may be an important evolutionary step. In his essay, Anderson argues that the disturbances that human beings are visiting on the planet must be leading to increasing cases of hybridization everywhere, and that thousands of these hybrids and their habitats may prove to be the seedbeds of new evolutionary lines. In his view, the crucial evolutionary step comes not with the first hybrid generation, but with the second. The first hybrid will be uniform in its requirements, and on the whole, they will be for conditions intermediate between those required for the two parents, Anderson writes. This is just what the Grants are seeing with Darwin's finches. The first generation of hybrids is intermediate in beak and body. But from their offspring, surprises may come. The second generation will be made up of individuals, each of which will require its own peculiar habitat, Anderson writes, and repeats the statement in block letters. The second generation will be made up of individuals, each of which will require its own peculiar habitat for optimum development. In other words, the offspring of hybrids will be novel and bizarre, and they will require habitats as novel and bizarre as they are themselves. Anderson showed how this might happen in a study of two species of spiderwort that grow wild in the Ozarks. One grows in deep, dark woods at the foot of cliffs, he says, while the other grows in full sun at the top of the cliffs. In many ways, these habitats are polar opposites. The species at the base of the cliffs requires rich loam, deep shade, leaf mold cover, while the species at the top of the cliffs requires rocky soil, full sun, no leaf mold cover. The two spiderworts, he says, are well-differentiated species. Neither one of them is by any means the closest relative of the other. He could cross them readily in experimental gardens, where he learned to recognize the distinctive appearance of the hybrids. But he seldom found one of the hybrids growing in the wild, because the Ozarks rarely provided an intermediate habitat. Not even the very middle of the cliff would do. Anderson did find a few of these hybrids growing wild in the woods. "Imagine what would happen if these hybrids crossed," he writes. "Their offspring, by shuffling their diverse sets of genes, would now require six new habitats besides their parents' two: rich loam, full sun, no leaf mold, rocky soil, deep shade, leaf mold. Rich loam, full sun, leaf mold. rocky soil, full sun, leaf mold. Rich loam, deep shade, no leaf mold. Rocky soil, deep shade, no leaf mold. The actual number of differences between any two species is much greater than in this schematic example. What is more, Anderson points out, the number of different habitats the hybrids require will rise exponentially with the number of basic differences between the species. With 10 such differences, around 1,000 different kinds of habitat would be needed to permit the various recombinations to find a niche somewhere. With only 20 such basic differences, and this seems like a conservative figure, over 1 million different recombined habitats would be needed. You don't find situations that chaotic under natural conditions, but you do find them in the havoc that human beings bring in their train. Our arrival, Anderson says, can provide strange new niches of hybrid recombinations. Thus, our disturbances hybridize both the environment and the species. We are hybridizing the planet. Botanists have actually watched this happening. Farmers on the Mississippi Delta treat their lands slightly differently, and botanists have discovered that different wildflower hybrids flourish in the different conditions on each farm. The land is the same, the climate is the same, but the hybrids, as Anderson writes, sometimes go right up to the fence line at the border of the farm and stop there. The same sort of pattern has been documented in the fields and pastures of the St. Lawrence Valley and elsewhere. One botanist has looked at two species of sage that grew in the chaparral of the San Gabriel Mountains. In the chaparral itself, he found no hybrids, but he did find them flourishing next to it in an abandoned olive orchard. In this greatly disturbed area, new niches were created for the hybrid progeny, which are apparently always being produced in the chaparral, but at very low frequency, Anderson writes. In this strange new set of various habitats, some of the mongrels were at a greater selective advantage. The sage in the deserted olive orchard was composed of hybrids, and almost none of the original species grew there.